I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and the verdict is in. On their 10th day of deliberation, jurors have found former Vice Presidential Chief of Staff Louis Scooter Libby guilty of obstruction of justice in the case that centered on how a CIA agent's name was leaked to the media. Louis was not charged with leaking the name of Agent Valerie Plame, who's married to Bush administration critic Joseph Wilson. Louis was accused of taking part in a White House campaign to discredit Wilson. Joining us on the line from Washington is George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, a story, it's gone on for 4 weeks, a five-week trial, 4 years rather, a five-week trial, 19 witnesses, and now this verdict just in. Your reaction?
Well, it's obviously a serious blow for the White House. You could not get a piece of paper between Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney when they were working together. He was, for all purposes, Dick Cheney. When Dick Cheney had a task, he carried it out. And so for him to be found guilty of obstruction really does cast a long shadow, a shadow that most certainly falls over Cheney himself.
And again, we should say the verdict is just in, and Louis Libby charged with obstruction of justice and 4 of 5 counts of obstruction of justice. I suppose we can't go over the whole story, but of course the story arose after a White House critic, as we said, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, wrote that the White House was misusing evidence of weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to the war in Iraq. What exactly was Libby charged with?
Well, he was charged with both perjury and obstruction of justice that stems from his statements to federal investigators and a federal grand jury. He told both the investigators and the grand jury that he had no recollection of discussing Mrs. Wilson with reporters like Judith Miller, who used to be with New York Times, or Matt Cooper, who used to be with Time Magazine. And what happened was that many of these journalists ultimately contradicted him, as did non-journalists. There were a fairly large number of witnesses who said that Mr. Libby did indeed speak to them, unprompted, about Ambassador Wilson's wife, about how she worked at the CIA. Now, this was very much part of the game plan of the White House at that time. In this trial, we got a glimpse into what is usually a very insular White House. And it does appear that when Wilson's article hit the New York Times, it had a considerable effect within the White House. And one of the first people to see its importance was indeed Dick Cheney, who reacted very quickly and spoke to the man that carries out things that Cheney wants to be done, and that would be Scooter Libby.
In fact, I'm looking at an article in the New York Observer by Sidney Schamburg, who makes the out-and-out claim that what the Libby trial has done is expose sort of a shadow government in the White House run by Dick Cheney, carrying out his plans. You know, in addition to what it obviously has said about Scooter Libby, who, again, if you've just joined us, has been declared guilty on 4 or 5 counts of obstruction of justice, we want to get back to that. But what else does it say about the vice president's office?
Well, the trial itself, ironically, showed Dick Cheney as most people view him in the public realm. You know, many celebrities are quite different in private. On this occasion, Dick Cheney appeared to be exactly as he appears, sort of the face of wrath of the administration, the guy who calls most of the shots. When Wilson's article came out, it was Dick Cheney that wrote in the margins and dispatched people like Libby to deal with it. It was Dick Cheney who was one of the first to inquire as to the relationship between Wilson's wife and his being sent to Niger. It was Dick Cheney who was very sensitive about claims that not only did he overplay the WMD argument for the war, but that he was personally connected to the Niger trip. So this has an enormous amount of implication for the White House and specifically Dick Cheney. This is when you talk about obstruction of justice with someone like Libby, there are very few people above his pay grade. When he was in the White House, Scooter Libby was one of the biggest, fiercest animals in D.C., a city filled with big, fierce animals. He was one of the biggest. Above him, you run right into the vice president. So you can't really talk about this conviction without talking about the man he worked for.
Well, but really, because, again, according to the indictment, Louis Libby lied during the interviews. But can't the vice president's office say we had no idea he was lying, or we didn't authorize his lying, or
Oh, they're certainly going to do precisely that. You know, this is a city where they used to say, if you want a friend, buy a dog. And Scooter Libby has had a real nosebleed of a fall from a man who had many friends to a man who has none. So you're going to see a lot of distancing occurring today with the White House. But it's not very persuasive. You know, many of us criticized the investigation because it seemed to avoid Dick Cheney. When you looked at who was interviewed, if you read the report of the prosecutors, whenever they got close to Cheney himself, the lights would go off on the investigation. They wouldn't mention him, even when it was perfectly absurd, where you knew he had to be the guy in the vice president's plane. So this really, in a strange way, adds to some criticism for the prosecutors. If Scooter Libby was involved in this type of obstruction of justice, many people in this town will believe that he did not do it alone. He's not a rogue operator. Far from it. Scooter Libby is the ultimate messenger guy. He's what we used to call a button man. He acted on the orders of Dick Cheney. So there'll be a lot of people today asking why the prosecutors did not press Cheney more, why he was not called to the grand jury.
Again, Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, talking about the verdicts that have come in, saying that Louis Libby, aide to the vice president, is guilty of 4 or 5 counts of obstruction of justice. I just want to ask you briefly about that third count. It's centered on what Libby told Time magazine correspondent Matthew Cooper. If you could give us just a, you know, remind us of what that relationship was said to be, and what do you think the jurors were wrestling with there?
Well, the jurors had a lot of problem with that particular count. They weren't sure whether the government apparently had proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. So they asked the court to sort of explain how much doubt is too much, essentially. And there was a considerable debate between the judges, the prosecutors, and his defense counsel. So it appears that the jury decided to let that one go because they were somewhat uncertain. As it stands, it's going to make very little difference in Libby's life. These counts that he was convicted of could carry a maximum sentence of 30 years. At the end of the day, it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. There also will be a question about Ted Wells and how well he crafted this defense.
Ted Wells?
He is the chief defense attorney and somewhat of a legend in the courtroom. But in this case, many of us were very surprised. He adopted an extremely conservative and restrained defense. I personally was critical of his decision not to put Libby on the stand. I think that this is a lot like the Martha Stewart case, where if a defendant does not go on the stand, the jury tends to really resolve all doubts against them. They shouldn't, but that's the practical effect. Jurors expect you to get on the stand when people are saying you're a liar.
I want to ask you, too, as you said, there are questions that are surfacing. Why didn't the prosecutors bring Dick Cheney to the stand as well? But there are other questions. And just to remind us, why, Richard Armitage, who was the undersecretary of state, has said that he was the one who inadvertently leaked the name of Valerie Plame, the CIA agent. And Robert Novak, was the syndicated columnist, was the person who first wrote it. Why aren't either of them at all charged with anything?
That's a great question. This is truly a play built for Washington. It has no redeeming characters. Everyone is acting badly. And Novak is a great example of that. Novak never explained fully why he outed Valerie Plame. He was asked by the CIA not to do it, that releasing her identity would end her career. The only reason he did that was pure vengeance against Wilson through his wife. But he, as you note, really did not face any repercussions. The same can be said with Armitage, that he not only revealed the identity, but he went for the longest time letting other people speculate, let other individuals bear the criticism as the supposed leaker, and he just remained quiet. It was really a horrible performance on his part. The reason they are not charged is that this is a crime that's very difficult to prosecute. It's a badly crafted provision. That's one of the reasons they went after Scooter Libby for perjury and obstruction. That's a very common thing to see in Washington. People in this city tend to go to jail for how they responded to a scandal more than the scandal itself.
Well, and so now Louis Scooter Libby charged again with 4 counts of obstruction of justice, cleared on the, actually it was the 3rd count. He was charged with 4 others. There were a total of 5. And guilty of those 4. What happens now? Will there be an appeal?
Well, there certainly will be an appeal. The problem is that these are criminal counts that are hard to overturn on appeal. They come close to conspiracy. They're a very spongy type of criminal counts that are often somewhat armor-plated for appeal. The jury is allowed to read the credibility of these witnesses and to judge them. And in this case, they believed the prosecution's witnesses, and Libby, by not taking the stand, did not give them any reason to doubt it. That's the reason I was so critical when they decided not to put him on the stand. To me, it seemed that the government had carried their case. By the time they had rested, these were very persuasive witnesses. And by not putting Libby on the stand, Wells took a roll of the dice, but I would never have taken that bet.
Well, Jonathan Turley, you've got about a minute left. What about the media, the role of media giants that took the stand? Tim Russert, Judith Miller, some would say a fallen giant. We spoke about Matthew Cooper, Time Magazine. What did this trial tell us about the relationship between the media and their sources?
Well, I think that everyone looks badly here, I have to say. It really is a play without a redeeming character or even a morality that runs through it. In some ways, it fits this city well. You have reporters that were perhaps the worst actors of them all. You know, Judy Miller was an incredible embarrassment for the New York Times. She didn't even tell her editors. Bob Woodward, a legend in this town. If he was anyone other than Bob Woodward, he would have been fired by the Washington Post. He never told his editors. He went on programs doing interviews, never revealing that he also had sources in this, that he was also involved. You have Novak, who was something of a thug to trigger this whole thing. It's a terrible performance by the media. And quite frankly, the media has not cleaned up its own shop. They have not gone after people like Woodward or Novak and called them to account. It's a very bad performance by the media.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, weighing in on the Libby trial again. Libby charged with 4 counts of obstruction of justice. Jonathan, thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more allegations of intimidation and political pressure. But these came in a dramatic Senate hearing in Washington today, quite a day in Washington. Congress is investigating whether several former federal prosecutors were fired from their jobs for political reasons. The Bush administration ousted 8 U.S. attorneys last year. Today, 4 of those prosecutors testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor has been covering the hearings. She joins us from the Capitol. And Gail, I just want to ask you briefly if you had any thoughts on our breaking news story from Washington today. I just see this movement of reporters running from one side of the Capitol to the other as they follow these stories. You know, the fact that in the CIA leak trial, Louis Libby has been charged with 4 out of 5 counts of, found guilty of 4 out of 5 counts of obstruction of justice. Your thoughts?
We're not even talking about the Walter Reed case. This is the big difference with Democrats controlling the Congress.
And Gail, I know you meant the Walter Reed case.
I'm sorry, yes.
The Walter Reed Hospital scandal,
Walter
yes.
Reed Hospital, exactly.
Yes.
No, there is such an intense climate on Capitol Hill right now because any complaint is going to be picked up, and it's very likely going to be held in a public setting with subpoenas. So I think the Libby case, while Scott started well before Democrats took control, just is part of a mosaic here right now of how much more oversight, subpoenas, and questions are going to be asked.
Well, let's take a look at some of the questions being asked on the case of the fired prosecutors. The Justice Department has said that seven of the prosecutors were fired for failing to follow Bush administration policy. One was fired to make way for a former aide of White House political advisor Karl Rove. This whole investigation began after allegations that New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici may have tried to influence a federal investigation into Democrats to kind of get it to wrap up and condemn Democrats before the midterm elections. So give us the overarching out of today's hearing.
Well, I think the main point that came out of the hearing was the credibility of these prosecutors. Carol Lamb, who is the state attorney for the Southern District of California, made a statement for all of them, and she said that each of us is fully aware that we served at the discretion of the president and could be eliminated for little or even no reason. And she said, we declined to speculate on the reason. But pressed by Democrats especially, they did speculate on the reasons, and although we have not heard the other side yet, in a public forum, it looks very bad for the Bush administration. These were, in the words of a prosecutor, very compelling witnesses.
Well, the star witness was the former U.S. attorney from New Mexico. This is David Iglesias. Just as an aside, he was the inspiration for the Tom Cruise character in the film A Few Good Men. And he told of a phone call that he received, the one we spoke of, from Senator Domenici before the fall elections about this political corruption investigation into Democrats. Here's what Mr. Iglesias said today.
And he said, are these going to be filed before November? And I said, I didn't think so. And to which he replied, I'm very sorry to hear that. And then the line went dead.
So in other words, he hung up on you.
That's how I took that, yes, sir.
And he didn't say goodbye or anything
no,
like
sir.
That? Now, did you take that as a sign of his unhappiness with your decision?
I felt sick afterward.
Gail, we're told that was a chilling moment in this testimony.
Absolutely. In fact, it probably was a decisive moment because it was the sort of thing that people think that they understand. Now, Senator Spector, who's probably the best questioner on the Judiciary Committee, tried to poke a few holes in that testimony or at least get into it. You know, why didn't he say something at the time? What exactly did Senator Domenici say? Senators are very careful of a colleague who very likely now is going to face ethics charges. And he tried to pull him out on why he felt what exactly the senator might have said that was a threat or intimidating. But so many of us have been at the receiving end of a phone call, that phone that goes dead, that it's just tough. The Justice Department also revealed on Monday that Senator Domenici on several occasions complained about David Iglesias.
Well, and John McKay, a former U.S. attorney for Seattle, also testified. He said he got an email from Bud Cummins, the U.S. attorney from Arkansas, and in that email, Cummins was said to be relaying a conversation he'd had with a member of the Justice Department. And basically, McKay, who received the email, said he felt like he was trying to be silenced. Let's listen.
Public comments by former United States attorneys were intensely frowned upon by the Department of Justice, and we could expect repercussions if we continued to speak publicly.
You know, and Gail, some of the former prosecutors indicated they didn't want to create a controversy about their firings. So how do they all end up, testifying with this withering testimony of subpoenas?
Subpoenas, that is the big difference between Republican and Democratic control. They were brought in front of the committee by subpoena, and in fact this morning the House Judiciary Committee held a meeting to advance two more subpoenas to other of the eight who had been fired. So I think this is just beginning to get underway. The fact that they had to be subpoenaed, I think, helps their case because it looks as if they weren't trying to undermine the government.
Right, that they could still say they served at the pleasure of the president.
That's right.
Well, how much more are we going to see? The New York Times is reporting today about a Maryland prosecutor who says he was being pressured by former Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich not to investigate political corruption scandals involving some of Ehrlich's associates. And there, the article goes on to say that this Maryland prosecutor, Tom DiBiagio, may be fired. So how much more of this do you think there's going to be?
I expect you'll see a great deal more of it because this affects not just people who have been fired, there actually haven't been that many. The Congressional Research Service just did a report that signals out 8 that look especially political, but they involve things that can be readily identified. You know, one judge bit somebody, another one was charged with perjury, you know, things that are obvious. There aren't really obvious unprofessional activities here. Well, that's what makes these 8 cases so troubling.
Well, I was just going to ask, and I hate to do this to you in like 30 seconds, but to people who are saying, well, doesn't an administration have the right to hire and then fire people if they're not happy with the way they're running their offices?
Absolutely they do. However, as Senator Specter said, the Department of Justice needs to be a great deal more sensitive to what it looks like to fire 8 people all at once, several of whom were involved in important prosecutions of Republican politicians.
Gail Chadwick,
Democrat. I'm sorry, one of Republican, two of Democrats.
You're right.
Yeah.
Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Stay with us on a busy day in Washington. Who knows what's going to happen next? Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Want to reduce your risk of a heart attack? Take a nap. In the most extensive study yet of the health effects of napping, researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health and the University of Athens Medical School found that midday napping reduces the chance of death from heart disease by about a third for both men and women. Well, Sarah Mendick says that's just the start. Sarah is a researcher at the Salk Institute at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Take a Nap, Change Your Life. Sarah, I'm looking at your napping manifesto, that's in your book, and you say, yes, napping can reduce the risk of heart attack and also stroke, but it can also prevent diabetes, reduce stress, help you lose weight, preserve your looks, even help you do better at a learned motor performance. You tested people doing things like playing a musical instrument.
That's right. So the work that we did for my graduate degree at Harvard in the psychology department was actually doing these exact studies. So you did the morning testing of, you know, training on a motor skills task or a visual skills task, and then you either had a nap or you didn't in the afternoon, and then you were retested after the nap or after not having a nap. And what happened is that not only did people do better after the nap, but when you looked at people who didn't nap, they actually did worse than they had done in the morning performance. And so what there was two things that we really found from that was that napping really helps, and that also if you're not napping, you're hurting yourself.
Right. Well, you go on to show studies that say that sleepy people reach for high-fat, sugar-rich foods, so napping helps you lose weight. Sleepy people are more dependent on drugs and alcohol. In fact, you quote a study from Denmark showing that people who complain of exhaustion are more likely to abuse drugs. So the list goes on and on. Let's talk about why this happens. I mean, you talk about sleep cycles. What is it about sleep that helps prevent, for instance, heart disease?
What seems to be the case is that we're biological animals that really work on a certain cycle of being able to rest and being able to be active. And if you deprive yourself of that rest cycle, you go into sort of a hyperactive state, which is very stressful and very bad for any kind of the restorative processes that need to occur.
Sarah, you describe sleep cycles as being about 90 minutes long, and they just get repeated all night, and they include something called slow wave sleep, stage 2 sleep, REM sleep. We know what that is, the rapid eye movement sleep, and these sort of waves all through the night. What are those three stages briefly? Just tell us what each of them are.
Yeah, so stage 2 sleep, it's a very light form of sleep, but it's actually been shown to improve not only your alertness, but also your motor memory, your motor skills, so that what we were talking about before about riding a bicycle or learning how to type or learning how to play guitar. As you get into deeper stages of sleep, beyond the first 20 minutes of a sleep cycle, you actually start to get into a deep stage of sleep called slow wave sleep. And slow wave sleep is like 180 degrees different from waking. It's your electrical activity is very, very slow. Your blood flow in your brain is very, very slow. And this form of sleep has been shown to be very restorative for muscle tissue, for your brain. It's shown to sort of clear the decks of all the junk of information that we store all day long. And then as you go through about 60 minutes, you start to come out of slow wave sleep into a very light form of sleep called REM sleep. And REM sleep has been shown to improve your creativity, your perceptual processing, such as your visual skills, your auditory skills.
This is where you have wild dreams, right?
Exactly. That's right. The period of wild dreams. But what's interesting about nocturnal sleep versus napping is that in nocturnal sleep, you can't really control how you're sleeping. You just have to go through that full, you know, hopefully 8 hours of sleep that you're getting. In the nap, you can really change the amount of sleep that you get by what time you wake up. So if you're taking a nap of 20 minutes, the typical power nap, that nap is going to have a lot of stage 2 sleep, and it's very good for alertness and your motor skills. If you sleep a little bit longer, then you're going to get into the slow wave sleep. And then if you sleep even longer, then you get into REM sleep.
Well, and can you have all three? Because we're told that we really shouldn't sleep more than 20 minutes at a time for a power nap because we might get sluggish.
There is a danger of going into what's called sleep inertia if you wake up from slow wave sleep, that deep, heavy sleep. And what that means is that your brain just can't seem to get back into that
right.
excitatory waking state. But there are things that you can do, such as sleep either, as you said, 20 minutes so that you don't get into slow wave sleep, or sleep up to an hour. An hour will allow you to go all the way through slow wave sleep and come out at the other end.
Huh.
But if you do wake up in slow wave sleep, there are things you can do, such as splash water on your face, get a little bit of exercise, and even just have a little bit of coffee just to sort of tide you over that period.
Because otherwise you'd be groggy.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And if you're trying to take the 20-minute nap, you suggest setting the alarm. They have them on cell phones and things. It's easy
yeah,
to
do. And also the good thing is that with all of these skills, including, you know, learning how to exercise correctly, eat correctly, it's a skill that you can practice and you can get better. If you ever speak to people who have been napping for many, many years, they tell you that they always began sort of trying to figure out what the right time was, and it took a little while, but then suddenly their naps became actually just part of their day and became much more efficient. And that's actually what happened to me. I used to nap for an hour every day during grad school, and at this point I nap for about 15 minutes every day, and I get the same benefits. I feel exactly the same sort of feeling of rejuvenation and restoration as I did with that hour.
Couple last questions. I mean, who knew there was so much to know about napping?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the preventive nap, a nap you can take in anticipation of being sleepy, you know, something that's coming up. But I thought you couldn't do that.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that there's really three different kinds of naps when you talk about, you know, how to prepare for napping if you're not going to have a lot of sleep. There's the preventative nap, as you say, so you nap before work. There's the operational nap, so you nap during work. Or there's the more restorative, recuperative nap, which is napping after work. And studies have shown that the most effective nap for being able to be up for a long time is the preventative nap, is actually taking a nap just before you go to work, say if you're somebody who's been up all day, but then you also have a night job, and so you've got to do the night shift. The best thing is actually to take a good long nap right before you go to work, say at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m., and that will allow you to actually have sustained, safe performance for a longer period of time rather than a short nap in the middle, and definitely much better than a nap when you get home.
Well, as far as the napping during the day goes, if you don't have a nap room, I mean, are people really approaching management and asking for a place to nap? I mean, because how do you do it?
Well, it usually doesn't happen from the bottom up. It's usually a top-down decision. A CEO is probably a napper and decides that, actually, if I'm napping, why shouldn't everybody be getting the benefits? There are definitely businesses that call me and say, well, we want to start to, you know, have napping go on in our offices. How can we do that? And I'm helping people set up nap rooms in their businesses. So there are, slowly but surely, businesses who are sort of focusing more on the health aspects of napping and deciding, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing to have people sleeping at work. And even people whose bosses don't know that they nap usually will find time at their lunch break. They'll nap in their car. You know, if you have an hour, then you can have lunch for half an hour and just nap for 20 minutes in the car. Another aspect of napping is it's easy to nap in the car when you arrive someplace at your next appointment a little bit early and set your cell phone and just, you know, for a 15-minute nap and have it wake you up. And, you know, finding places in your day that you can just take a 15-minute break rather than, you know, take a half an hour, go down to Starbucks and spend $5.
Well, as I said, who knew? Sarah Mednick did. She's a researcher at the Salk Institute at the University of California, San Diego, author of Take a Nap, Change Your Life. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, and if you've just tuned in, our top story again today. Louis Libby has been found guilty of 4 of 5 charges of obstruction of justice in the CIA leak case, the prosecutor saying lying under oath can never be acceptable. So a busy day. Not a lot of naps today in Washington. You're listening to Here and Now. Ann Coulter is now pretty much saying, shame on you if you thought she was speaking ill of John Edwards. You've probably heard the right-wing pundit's comments about presidential candidate John Edwards when she spoke to the American Conservative Union last week.
I was going to have a few comments on the other Democratic presidential candidate, John Edwards, but it turns out that you have to go into rehab if you use the word faggot. So...
Well, last night on Fox News, Coulter defended her use of that word.
The word I used has nothing to do with sexual preference. It is a schoolyard taunt, and unless you're going to announce here on national TV that John Edwards, married father of many children, is gay, it clearly had nothing to do with that. It's a schoolyard taunt.
What? Is it possible that the word that's been used so violently against homosexual men has nothing to do with sexuality? And what exactly is it, if not that? Well, we decided to call Jonathan Barnes, assistant professor of linguistics at Boston University. Jonathan, what's the derivation?
It's a little bit unclear. There are a number of theories out there. One of them brings in the bundle of sticks meaning that I guess most school children who look it up in the dictionary know about. And the idea there is supposed to be that at some point in the past, they were burning, among other people, homosexuals at the stake, and the word to refer to the sticks they were using ultimately came to refer to the people they were burning instead.
So that obviously is a pejorative.
Obviously, yeah. That strikes me as also probably a pretty improbable derivation for it. And the reason is that the homosexual meaning actually only crops up in the United States during this century.
Well, in fact, when I first called you, you said, oddly enough, others had been calling you about this word even before the Ann Coulter comment.
Yeah.
What did you find?
Yeah, what I did find is that a first reference to this meaning is actually from 1591, and it continues right up until this century. It's used by James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence to refer to a disagreeable woman of some sort. The definition they give is a term of abuse or contempt applied to a woman. And that then turns into, in the United States specifically, a derogatory term for a homosexual. That actually makes a lot of sense because derogatory terms for homosexuals frequently end up being derived from derogatory terms for women.
So what do you think of Ann Coulter's claim now that it's become just a schoolyard taunt? And we've heard this from others, that they actually hear it on the playgrounds, that kids say it to each other. What do you think of that? That it doesn't have, as she said, a sexual connotation?
It strikes me as not all that plausible, but it certainly happens that words change their meanings in that kind of way. In other words, they start out meaning, say, bad in some very specific way, and they come to be bleached of that the original specificity or concreteness of the meaning and end up meaning just kind of bad in general.
Well, as long as, and you know, some parents I'm sure are reeling, but as long as we're talking about the bad words, when I was younger, the word suck, S-U-C-K, was just a foul word. You could not say that.
Because it had a very specific sort of physical meaning, yeah.
And yet now, it's Homer Simpson.
Yeah, it's completely devoid of that meaning. It just means is bad.
But that didn't apply to a person. Do you think, I mean, much as the N-word for African-Americans, there was a movement to own the N-word, to rob it of its negativity. Are you as a linguist seeing that in the gay community with the F-word, if you will?
I think when you talk about things like the N-word, or it's difficult to talk about their meanings because it's not just the literal meaning of the word that's at stake, but rather the whole sociological context in which they've been used. So it's a lot different than just, say, the word suck coming to now mean bad, whereas previously it meant whatever exactly it meant.
You actually noticed a news story recently of a young child who did use what's thought of as a pejorative and
that's
didn't
right,
think it
yeah.
was.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't remember the specifics of it. It was some schoolboy said that something was so gay, and he didn't mean that it was homosexual. He meant it was bad or laughable or something. And, that, you know, that's probably true. It seems like something that I've heard, and certainly if he was referring to some sort of general situation on the playground rather than a specific person with a specific sexual orientation, then probably he didn't mean it that way. And that would be an example of this kind of semantic bleaching that I was talking about.
How much does it matter if the gay community thinks that it is offensive?
To the extent that it's a slur, and slurs are a form of verbal violence, they're meant to offend people. The diagnostic of whether they're offensive or not is whether the community is offended by them. I guess that's just something that we could determine empirically by asking members of the community.
Yeah. Boston University linguist Jonathan Barnes, well, let's do that. We called the gay activist group the Log Cabin Republicans. They say, quote, Ann Coulter should be embarrassed by her anti-gay remarks. She's made a career out of increasingly outrageous things just to shill her books. She obviously has no shame. So as far as they're concerned, still a slur. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The Johnny Carson Show, starring Johnny Carson.
It's June 30th, 1955, and a rail-thin Johnny Carson, his suit hanging off him as if he were a coat rack, takes the stage in his first primetime TV series, Before the Tonight Show. It's a moment in television history that can now be seen for the first time in more than 50 years. The Johnny Carson Show on CBS lasted just one season, 1955 to 56. It flopped, the show was canceled, and Johnny was heartbroken. But 6 years later, he took the Tonight Show chair and kept it warm for 30 years, saying goodnight for the last time in 1992. Now, 10 long-lost episodes of that first show are available on DVD, thanks to Joanne Carson, the second of the four Carson wives, who recently rediscovered the old kinescopes. And what a find. By the way, you can see some of the old shows. Go to our website, here-now.org, while Joanne Carson joins us from her home in California. Joanne, welcome.
Thanks so much, Robin. I'm happy to be here.
Boy, I have to say, I'm just flooded with memories looking at these, but I want to get your thoughts. When you first, you know, saw them again, what came back for you?
Well, a lot of warm memories, because Johnny kind of used these tapes to court me when we first met in 1960. And he said to me after dinner, would you like to come up and see a show I did? And it's like I said to him, is this a new way of come up and see my etchings? And he turned bright red, Robin. He was so embarrassed. That's the first time I realized how shy Johnny really was.
Right, and how sort of all-American. And you were an actress, a model. You had your own show at the time, did you not?
Right.
Yeah.
I was on Video Village daytime and nighttime, and Johnny was on Who Do You Trust daytime.
So who's this guy coming along? Because you already have your own show. We heard an introduction of the first show. But let's listen to a little bit of that opening monologue.
Now, before we go any further tonight, and we are going to go further tonight, I say that because we've had some excellent reports on the show so far in the 4 minutes we've been on. And I understand the switchboards are jammed out here at CBS. Everyone is calling. Everyone has been asking, are you going to go further tonight?
Joanne Carson, again, this is before Johnny Carson had done anything, really, before he was asked to replace Jack Parr.
Well, this was his first network show, and this was his breakthrough. Yeah. These were the kind of shows that Johnny loved to do because he was able to write his own material.
I want to thank, first of all, the people who've been writing in, and this is mainly ladies in the middle-age bracket, because, I don't know, they kind of think that I'm undernourished. And one lady paid a repairman, a TV repairman in St. Louis, $15 to take a long, narrow streak out of her television tube. It turned out to be me.
You know, some would say, Joanne Carson, that this is the Johnny Carson before fame gives people the edges that they naturally get. And I'm just wondering, you know, your thoughts on hearing that, because that was the Johnny Carson that really was the Johnny Carson you
were. Johnny Carson I fell in love with. And it's kind of bittersweet to hear that, because it brings back all those memories of when Johnny showed me these shows one at a time, and then all of a sudden, for my birthday and Valentine's Day and Christmas, he gave me one of the shows. So I collected all 10 shows. And I had put them away in a little wine chest in the back of the closet. And you know how you kind of forget about things after a while?
Well, I'm not sure I'd forget if I had Johnny Carson's first TV shows in my mind, but yes.
No, I didn't forget that they were there. It's just that Johnny, maybe 6 months before he died, said to me, I wish you would do something with those shows, Joe, because they're really fun to watch. And this is kind of my gift to the American public and his fans, because he wanted these out. And I would take them home to show to kids, because kids just get hysterical over these. The humor is raw and funny, and it's pure Johnny.
Let's listen to another clip, and it's a parody of a famous mind reader, and Tonight Show fans are going to recognize the character as the early model for Carnac the Magnificent. Let's
exactly.
listen.
Yeah.
Now, Ralph, and I perceive that Ralph Grant is not your real name. Is that true?
That's right.
It seems to me that it's a phony, a cover-up, that you're hiding something.
That's right.
Your real name, or you're possibly better known as X-139.
That's right.
You are a spy?
That's correct.
I get the impression you were brought to this country by submarine?
That's right.
You're here on a very dangerous mission. You're going to plant a bomb and blow up the nation's capital in Washington?
That's right.
Thank you. Give the man a nice round of applause, please.
Joanne Carson, again, you know, Johnny Carson went on, of course, to The Tonight Show, and you went as well. The more famous he got, the harder it got for you.
Basically, Robin, I'm a very private person. I was raised in a convent, and I'm a very low-key person. So that when Johnny and I met, we got along because we were both very private people. In the event of The Tonight Show being so successful, there was more and more demands on his time and my time, and going places and benefits and dinners and parties, and it really wasn't for me. I'm a little girl from California. You know, I'm the ponytail sneaker kind of person. And that social life was just more than I needed to handle.
You know, we all know who watched The Tonight Show that Johnny's ex-wives became a part of his stand-up. In fact, you're quoted as saying that the line he used after your divorce was, "She left me with a hassock and a hairnet."
Oh, that's a hysterical line. That is really a funny line. And Johnny said to me, "You know, there's something funny about those two words, hassock and hairnet."
He really is, especially so, picturing him in them.
But the thing of it was is that we stayed friends. So Johnny and I were together emotionally from 1960 until the time he passed. And he was my best friend all those years.
One last question.
Sure.
You know, you say you're very shy, and, you know, the limelight that The Tonight Show cast on you as a family wasn't for you, but he was so shy, too.
He always was shy. But, you see, his wives brought wonderful things into his life. I brought The Tonight Show. Jody, his first wife, brought his children and supported him through these early shows. And then Joanna helped him get more in society and get him a little bit more social. Alex was the best of all because she supported him through The Tonight Show. She got him to Africa. She got him through his retirement years. It's not an easy thing to span those many years with one person. And I really understand why he had four wives. Each of us were kind of a different segment of his life that he needed at that time.
You know,
and Johnny had incredible taste. He married some very outstanding women.
Well, and that's been said, and some would say this is, you know, very generous of you and, you know, would be difficult for some women to talk so generously about other wives.
Let me tell you something, Robin. Johnny was one of a kind. He was the best of the best. And the fact that we were married 10 years and we were friends for over 4 years, what more can you ask for? Mm. He was the most real person, the most caring, sensitive man I've ever met. Very, very sensitive, which made him a great comedian.
Thank you and good evening. I'm Johnny Carson. Now, the reason I say that is because I'm the only one who came out here when they introduced me.
I've noticed on television. 10 episodes of The Johnny Carson Show, his first television show that aired in 1955 and 56, are now out on DVD. To see some and to find out how to get them, go to our website, here-now.org. And Joanne Carson, who rediscovered these old kinescopes, thanks so much for sharing your memories with us.
Oh, Robin, thank you for having me.
Before you go, I just want to tell you this story. Johnny Carson was my first interview ever.
Oh, my God.
And I was assigned in 75, 76 by a television show to go get this interview by getting on an airplane, flying to the West Coast, and flying with him back to the East Coast, and somehow getting myself seated near him and his then-wife, Joanna. And you know what happened?
What?
She got airsick and threw up on me.
No.
And I got the interview. And you know what he told me? He said, I was just going into television at the time, and he said, "Be careful, because this is an industry that cannibalizes its young."
Well, that's what happened in the first shows of his, The Johnny Carson Show. Mm. He really felt they cannibalized him.
Joanne, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI.